Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor superfan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hour 3, G-Bag Nation here on 105.3 The Fan. I hope you're having a fantastic day. Rangers pregame coming up in 2.5 hours. Looking forward to that. Sansa's going to join you coming up at 4:40. Let's chat with David Murphy, a Rangers legend. Incredible run with the team from 07 to 2013. Two World Series. Had a knack for hitting bombs and punishing pitchers who tried to throw inside on him too much. It's the great David Murphy here with you on 105.3 The Fan. And a good afternoon, sir. How the heck are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing good. You know, would have liked to be 1-0 right now, but it's one of 162, as they say. What'd you think of the boys there on opening day?
You know, they had some good at-bats. They battled. It was a tough one in the end. You know, especially I think it's easy to pick it apart, right? When you got two great back end guys in Kirby Yates and Robertson who leave and I think the fan base would love to see those guys replaced, or obviously it looks like Robertson's going to retire. Kirby Yates is a Dodger. So it can be frustrating. It's easy to second guess from the very beginning, but like, you know, we all know baseball's 162. You can't make any rash decisions. There's enough talent on this roster. Once they get rolling, I think we all have a pretty good feeling that it's going to be a pretty strong year.
Hey, Murph, as a player, is it a relief to have opening day over?
I guess so. I think more than anything, and it's not, it's really, we talk so frequently that baseball's routine oriented, right?
Sure.
So these guys are used to, take a guy like Marcus Semien. Everybody talks about how he's like the first guy at the ballpark every day in spring training. So we're talking about a guy that's probably waking up at 5-something. He's getting to the ballpark super early, and this is in the West Coast time zone. They got a few night games toward the end of spring training, and then the season starts, and you got this burst of adrenaline. You know, you've been dealing with warmer weather, you're back indoors, and then you're going to go to Cincinnati next week and play in the 40-degree weather. So your body is reacclimating to all these different things. So on one hand, yes, you're excited to have opening day over with, but I think it's still going to be another week or two, not just for the Rangers, but for all these major league teams to really find routine in the regular season.
We got Leiter on the bump tonight, Murph. What are your expectations for Leiter, but also his former Vandy teammate, Kamar Rocker, who ended up making the starting rotation, really due to a couple of injuries, but we're excited to see the youngsters.
You know, sometimes it's a blessing in disguise, right? It wasn't planned on, but maybe it can thrust these guys into, you know, what Rangers fans, what coaches and front office members have been expecting of them from the time that we drafted them. The high ceiling is there for both of them. I didn't get to see Leiter in any of the games that I did in spring training, but I saw Rocker the other day in the final exhibition game. You know, his fastball command was a little bit spotty, but he was landing his breaking ball, and then the fastball command got better throughout the course of it. So we're talking about upper 90 feet with both of them. And I don't know, true promise. So I think it's going to be awesome to see how they react to being on the opening day roster for the first time. And, I'm pretty optimistic with what they're going to be able to do.
Catching up with one of my all-time favorite Rangers, David Murphy, here in the G-Bag Nation. So our buddy Jared Sandler put out matchup to watch for tonight. Adolis Garcia is 4-for-7 with 2 homers in his career against Tanner Houck. So for a hitter, if you know, hey, coming into tonight, I've had success against this guy, how much more confident does that make you, or is the history kind of thrown out the window?
No, absolutely. You feel great stepping in a box against a guy that you've had success against. Houck tries to throw from the extreme third base side, and he loves his breaking ball. And we all know with the type of swing that Adolis has that he takes advantage of breaking balls that are located in the middle of the zone. So is Hout going to adjust off of that? We'll see. But you better believe that Adolis has that advantage, and you better believe that Hout knows that Adolis has that advantage.
Hey, Murph, I just want to ask you this about, again, as the former player situation, which is a bigger struggle to start the season, though, your hitting or your defense?
I think that is a different question each year.
Okay.
And I guess from a defensive standpoint, there's some variables that go into that. You know, as a hitter, some years you feel locked in, you know, 2 weeks into spring training.
Mm-hmm.
And you're ready for the season to start right now, and there's a little bit of pressure. You're thinking, all right, I got to make sure I stay locked in for another few weeks before, you know, at-bats count. And then there's a guy like I was in town in Surprise in mid-March when the guys still had 2 weeks left. And I was talking to Josh Smith, and I said, are you ready to get out of here? And he's like, well, not really. I'm working on a few swing things.
Mm-hmm.
And the extra few weeks give a hitter like that the opportunity to make the adjustments that he needs. Defensively, I think the main difference, especially I guess I'm speaking from an outfielder standpoint since I was an outfielder, is you kind of have to reacclimate yourself to the third deck again and reading the ball, you know, that may get caught up in the fans and in the background on higher fly balls.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't know. I guess that may be a better question for an infielder because they have a lot more things to take care of than, I mean, as an outfielder, I'm supposed to go run and catch the ball. If it's a hit, I throw it to the first guy I see. It's right. Pretty simple out there.
It's David Murphy here with you on The Fan. Now, you probably saw Josh Young got everybody a bunch of gifts. It was interesting to see like a non-veteran throwing around dough like that for his guys, but he wants to foster sort of a selfless type of culture there in the clubhouse. Were you a gift guy? Did anybody ever drop a great gift on you going into opening day or anything like that?
Well, I guess the one gift that I got, you know, the tradition in baseball is if somebody comes on the team and takes your number, then, you know, the unwritten rule says that you give them a gift. And so we traded for Pudge. We traded back for Pudge
yeah.
in 2009, and he was only with us for a month or two. And at the time, my first number with the Rangers was 28, and then Kevin Mensch actually took that from me the next year, which wasn't a big deal because I only had 2 months of major league time. So I was happy to give it up. And then I started wearing number 7. So I had it about almost 2 years when Pudge got traded back. And I gladly gave that up for him. And he bought me like this souped up, nice laptop.
There you go.
So, yeah, so that was
worth
nice.
It.
Yeah, I'll take that, and that's a good memory.
Murph, what were your thoughts on Evan Carter? And he didn't make the big league club. He's going to get everyday time there at Round Rock. But former outfielder, or he is a current outfielder. You're a former outfielder, both 6'3", both bat lefty. Did you see anything that you could give him advice, like from your game? I mean, you do kind of have similar body types, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess, you know, if we're comparing, I think he's a better defender than I was. He's faster. He's going to steal more bases than I did. When you breeze through the minor leagues and you get to the big leagues at such a young age, and then you make your presence felt the way that he did in a major league lineup that wins a World Series, like huge expectations are going to be put on you. So I think I would encourage him more on the mental side. Because he's still young, and we have every reason to believe that he's still going to have a super successful major league career. I would also encourage him to, and I don't know, I haven't talked to Evan a ton previously, but I wouldn't let him be bothered by all of the public talk of his performance against left-handed pitching. Because it's such a small sample size, I think he needs to go focus on doing damage against righties. And then his at-bats, the quality of his at-bats against lefties, they're naturally going to come around. So when you've had an injury-filled season like he did last year, I think it's important that he just gets reps under his belt. And I think it's not going to take him too long to be the Evan Carter that we all know and love and that played such a big impact for this team a few years ago. So baseball is so mental. I would imagine that he is frustrated, that he could be down. I'm not going to speculate there, but you know, that these types of things that happen to you earlier in your career, they only make you mentally stronger. So with everybody that's on the inside, the way that they talk about his personality, his character, this is only going to improve that, so that when he gets back up to the big leagues, he's going to be full go.
You can have a pretty nice career just tearing up right-handed pitching out there, can't you, playing decent outfield?
Absolutely. And the expectations are obviously more for him. You know, he's a guy that could get 550, 600 at-bats. But let's be honest, like, baseball's hard as it is, and it's hard from a platoon standpoint. You don't see a ton of lefties that can dominate left-handed pitching. Like, if he's a guy that, with his speed especially, if he can hit 250 and he can have a 750 OPS against lefties, like, that's going to be a really big asset for this lineup.
David, how many games are you doing on TV this year? When are we going to see you?
I'm doing 44. You know, Bassick's going to do the majority of the first few weeks. I have the Angels series, I guess, that starts 2 weeks from Monday. So I'm excited to get out there. You know, obviously, Peterson, Berger, Higashioka, all the new faces, and then just the new Bulls. There's so much to be excited about this year.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your thoughts on this team. We look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Always enjoy it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Salute. There he goes, the great David Murphy here in the G-Bag Nation on 105 Through the Fan. Baylor guy. Everybody that was tuned in to the
great insight
Rangers World Series. He's there in 2010 and 2011. And he was that guy, that really good outfielder that could play most days, maybe wasn't the best against left-handed pitching, get him 400 or 500 at bats a year. And he'd be hitting 290 or 300 with 15 to 20 home runs, just an absolute critical piece of the lineup. And maybe Evan Carter can have a season, a career like that.
Yep.
That'd be incredible if you could write that into existence right now. But tonight, the story for your Texas Rangers is about Jack Leiter and how he can do here as he tries to build significantly on where he was last year, which did not go well. I think his ERA was over 9, but in spring training, what we just saw, he was a different guy. And his ERA was under 2.5. He struck out a guy per inning that he pitched. He increased his velocity on his fastball from like 95 to 97. And in some situations, he was even throwing triple digits on the gun.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for Jack Leiter tonight, Wolchuk.
Added the sinker, reworked the changeup as well. So I think really limiting the walks, that's going to be the big key here tonight for Jack.
All righty, it's the G-Back Nation here on 105.3 The Fan, and we have another evening of college basketball as well to be entertained by. That should be a whole heck of a lot of fun, as I don't know if we can get much better than last night, coming back
crazy.
From 16 down with 10 minutes to go and 13 down with 6 minutes to go for this Texas Tech Red Raider group. Farthest they've gone now since 2019 when
Final Four.
Chris Beard was there. Yeah. They went to the Final Four that year.
Yep.
But they have done a really nice job there with McCaslin of building maybe not a basketball powerhouse, but a very respectable basketball program. And now they find themselves in the Elite Eight against Florida on Saturday. And the man that will be on that call, who was on the call last night for their furious comeback win against Arkansas, it's the great Kevin Harlan with you here on The Fan. And a good afternoon, sir. How the heck are you?
I'm doing great. Enjoying just getting ready for our game tomorrow with Florida and the Red Raiders. And they played a valiant game last night coming back. That's a pretty big hole. And historically, coming back from a 16-point deficit at that level of the tournament was eye-opening. But now maybe they've recaptured some momentum. And who knows what they'll do against the number one seed in the tournament, Florida. One of the four number one seeds. They're going to be tough. But I think mentally and emotionally, maybe even more importantly, emotionally, I think they're going to be ready to go and letting it rip.
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, do you think it was over with 10 minutes to go, or did you think they had a shot to pull this off?
Well, I said during one of the commercials to our guys, I said the body language of Arkansas was so confident and thought, you know, if they can take that confidence into their game against Florida in the Elite Eight, that's going to really pay off because Florida is playing at such a high level. And then as it turns out, you know, you had this furious comeback. And you could just see, it's so funny with teams, especially kids this age, you know, when they're playing and they're feeling good about the way they're executing and just their body language tells so much. And then when it begins to go south a little bit and they get sideways, their body language just changes. They don't run as hard. They don't leap as high. They don't have, you know, kind of the bravado that a lead in a big game against a good opponent will give you, and you could see it changing in a very short amount of time. And you don't see it much at the pro level, but you see it at the college level, and we certainly saw it last night. Arkansas, you know, was kind of exceeding a lot of expectations anyway to make it this far. And Calipari in Sweet 16 games in his career had been 12-3, and they came out and they executed almost exactly how they had to. And all of a sudden it turned with about, like you say, about 10 minutes. They began the run and they were chipping away. And it was one of those things where it got out of hand and they could not recapture what they had. And Texas Tech, they smelled blood and they attacked and they got them.
Kevin, what do you think about this coaching matchup we now have? You brought up Coach Cal. We got Todd Golden from Florida and then Grant McCaslin, who I've got a soft spot for. I went to UNT, so got to see what he did turning around that program before Texas Tech. But these are two of the best young coaches in college basketball. This should be a fascinating matchup.
Well, I like Coach McCaslin for a variety of reasons. I think he really interacts, and I think Todd Golden does too. I think they are really connected to players. You know, we're in an age of college basketball now where you're really kind of like on an eight-month rental. You get these kids in August. They've come from all parts of the globe. You try to bring them together, tie them into one, make sure they hold onto the rope and don't let go. And as you go through the regular season, if you're in a good conference, you've got a lot of ups and downs. That's why you see a lot of 10-8 records, a lot of, you know, 11-7. You see kind of those records there where they're almost winning as much as they're losing. And yet it toughens them up for this time of the year. You hope that by this time of the year, you've become a team in a very short amount of time. Resumes are different, experience is different, but I think as a coach, you're furiously trying to get everybody on the same page, and you're still, I think, in a lot of ways, learning what these kids can do. Last week we were in Milwaukee, and we're talking with coaches from Illinois and North Carolina and Kentucky and Ole Miss, and talking about trying to, you know, rebuild, you know, bring in 12 kids and 7 or 8 of them are going to see major minutes. And they've all come from different systems and maybe 2 to 3 different schools. And you're trying to get everybody on the same page. And it's just very hard to do the let alone all the NIL and re-recruiting your own kids and working with the portal and forget all that. Just when you finally get your roster and you're taking a look at these kids and figuring out where they're from, what they've done, what kind of system they've played in, how they fit now with other players, and trying to, you know, work through the month of November and December and January, getting ready for conference play. And then you said, okay, now I think we know what we've got. But sometimes you really don't, and you're learning. And most of the coaches last week in Milwaukee and a couple here in San Francisco have said we're still kind of tinkering with stuff. And so it's a season-long process that is ever-evolving. And all these teams look so different almost from week to week and sometimes game to game because you find different combinations that might work. But it's tough on these coaches. And the ones that are this far, I really – my hat's off to them, man. They are navigating a very turbulent time.
Yeah, Kevin, you're so easy to talk to. I could see coaches walking up to you and kind of, you know, spilling their guts to you about stuff. And do you sense frustration by guys that, like, man, I just want to coach. I don't want to deal with all this other BS that's going on for this game.
Well, it's never been more complicated, I would say that. And you've got, you know, things that are going on outside of the game with the government and the NCAA, and they're trying to find some stability here and find some kind of an even playing surface. But right now, for instance, people are saying, look at all these major Power Four conference schools that are, have made it to the Sweet 16, and we're going to have name brands across the board. And usually we've got a mid-major in there, a smaller school, not from a power conference. The problem is all those kids from those mid-major schools are all going in the portal once they get pretty good at a school in the Missouri Valley or the A-10 or whatever, and they all go to these big schools. Like the starting center for Kentucky was 4 years at Belmont, and that coach there is brilliant. And he played 4 years in the Missouri Valley Conference at Belmont in Nashville, and now he's a starting center for Kentucky. And those are the kind of players that these mid-major schools are losing, and so you don't have them now. You don't have the potency of what once was, you know, a guy that recruited and kept maybe a marginal high school kid, a two- or three-star high school kid developed in the system. Now they all take off once they get good enough, and it's their prerogative, and I don't – there's nothing wrong with it. The problem is that, you know, there's going to be a casualty when they're – whenever there's a move, there's a counter move. And the move here is all these kids play at this upper level of basketball. And the bad side of it is, or the unfortunate side is, all these mid-major schools are losing all their great kids.
Yeah.
They're leaving Evansville, and they're going and they're going to Illinois, and so it's tough, you know. And a lot of it is predicated on how much they got in that their NIL. And we had a coach, and like I said, we've been in Milwaukee, so we've talked to a lot of major conference schools here and their coaches. And one guy was saying, I'm on a Zoom this morning talking to kids in the portal, and we knew going into this conversation with my staff all on Zoom with his representatives, wherever they were, and we knew that this kid was probably going to be like a seventh, sixth kid, might be able to start a little bit, but he was a good player that fit our style. But they're talking to him, and they got his representatives there on the other side, and the mom and dad and the uncle and everybody else that's a part of in these kids' heads, and they're sitting there talking, and finally they get down to what it really matters, the money, and so this coach says, well, that's our story. What do you think? And he goes, well, coach, I want to start at 1.5, and the coach said he hit the button on Zoom that knocks off the camera, that makes it blank, and he looked at his. And then he hit mute. And he said, "Did he say 1.5? Did I hear that right? I mean, like maybe he's a $100,000 kid, and he wanted $1.5 million to go to that school." And they turned it back on. And said, "Listen, hey, thanks. That right now doesn't work in our budget. If you find no takers and if you lower your price, let's resume this conversation." And then they move on to the next kid.
Sure.
And they got somebody else teed up, and they're going to talk to him. But and then you got to re-recruit your own kids. You get these kids, and if they're not happy with the minutes and the shots. And where they are, where they fit in the scheme of things, now you got to re-recruit them and say, hey, this was kind of one of those years where next year I'm going to go in the portal, coach. Sorry, and so they're gone, and you got the guys that are putting money in the collective and the NIL that have spent $450,000 on this kid, and now he's going to leave after 1 year, and he wasn't even that good when he was with you. Mm. So like it's a lot. There are a lot of layers to this, and there's no clear answer right now. It's gonna be a 5-year process minimum, I think, to get this thing settled out. But it does give a different feel. All that being said, these games are a lot of fun. And here's what we are seeing: we're seeing, you know, a lot of kids that are staying in school beyond when they graduate. They are getting a chance to go from a mid-major to a major. So you're seeing mature kids who want to be coached, who know maybe it's their last go around, who's they're in their fifth or their sixth year of college. The COVID kids are just, that string is just about over. And so now they're playing smart, they're mature, they can handle what's going on, and so there's a bright side to it, but man, it's a story, and it's not going away, and it's what all these coaches are dealing with.
It's Kevin Harlan with you here on 105.3 The Fan, just absolutely dropping knowledge on that. I think you framed it better than anybody I'd heard so far. But you're known for your great calls, Kevin, and I just thought maybe we could listen to last night's decisive moment with you, and then you tell us how you did. Here we go.
And now it's Darian Williams.
This is who you want.
Knox will pick him up. Williams corkscrews up, off, and down! It's a 2-point lead. Final seconds. Wagner with it. Driving on Hawkins. Firing off. Texas Tech has won! The Red Raiders have won!
Yeah.
In the second largest comeback ever in the Sweet 16!
I know that was poetry to Red Raiders fans. Kevin, how'd you do?
Well, it's only the second time I've heard it, but I will tell you, here is my problem with it, is that when Wagner was coming down for Arkansas, between our vantage point and where he was taking, I couldn't tell if it was a two or a three. He backed up and he almost got into 3-point, but I couldn't see because I was blocked out. And so the worst thing I could have done, he goes, yeah, this is for the lead and maybe the game. Or, you know, I couldn't tell if it was for a tie or for a lead. So I just had to say he fired it because I couldn't see where his feet were. And because I had an official and I had like three or four players in front. So that was the only thing I didn't like about the call. I like to make sure that I check some boxes, who's defending, you know, the situation and all that other stuff. So I'll have to go back and watch it and really look at it. But my recollection is that what the one replay that I have seen was he backed up and he was just – but I couldn't tell if he was above the arc or beneath the arc. And the worst thing I could have done is said, this is for the tie or this is for the lead, when it was wrong either way because I couldn't see his feet. Wow. So I just said he fired. Anyway, that's my early critique, but I'll go back and break it down.
That's fascinating to go inside the mind of a call like that. Yeah. How can you recognize stuff like that and still make the call so smooth, Kevin? Terrific job as always. We look forward to the call tomorrow night against Florida.
Thank you, guys. Always fun to be on. I sure appreciate your time.
Oh, the best. There he goes. Kevin Harlan with you here in the G-Bag Nation, voice of NBA and NFL and college football and college basketball, and he's our favorite.
Yeah.
Okay, we got Sands coming up here towards the end of the hour. We are running late, but we'll get the top 10 in. Well, Chuck, what's the subject matter?
All right, we'll be quick with this. Best foods on a stick on National Something on a Stick Day. What's your favorite food on a stick? That's next.
Yeah, buddy. Welcome back. It's time for Woolchuck's Top 10 at 420. Segment is brought to you by the Frankels. If you've been injured in a car or truck wreck, call the Frankels first, 214 or 817-333-3333. There's never an out-of-pocket cost. They only get paid when you win. It's the Frankels. Go to car and truck wreck attorneys in Dallas. It's also brought to you by Cars for Kids. Donate today, carsforkids.org. Jared Sandler's coming up here in a few minutes. It's time for Zach with an H to do his Top 10. Here he is, the Woolly Bully.
One of the more random national days on the calendar, National Something on a Stick Day. So I've got the top 10 foods on a stick. What's your favorite food on a stick? 877-881-1053. 469 said elote on a stick. Which, hey,
I don't know how you do that.
I guess it's corn on the cob and put a skewer through there.
Okay.
I guess that's how the cob's a
stick.
And then the 817 said your mom. Which is relatively rude. She's a very, very sweet lady.
Vulgar, unnecessary.
Geez, man.
Honorable mentions, we got the sausage on a stick.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather used to love that at the old Texas Stadium.
Sausage.
And then chocolate-covered bananas on a stick is an honorable mention as well.
You know what? The bananas dipped in chocolate with you put walnuts and stuff on it. Yeah.
And you kind of freeze them a little bit so they're hard. That's some good stuff right there.
Yep. Hard.
Heard.
It's hard. Number 10 is cake pops.
Yes, delicious. Amazing.
Cake pops are fantastic.
Target has some good ones.
Yeah, I've had them, and you're right. You're not wrong about that. That's good.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Number 9 is cheese.
It's all about that. Was that called confection icing, or what is that called?
Confection sugar. It's like a powdered sugar. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I think I said the wrong thing. Oh. It's the fancy icing that goes on top of stuff.
I think I know what you're talking about.
It's not confection. It's Is it confection? It is confection.
Confection is definitely a word.
Yeah.
I think
that's like a powdered sugar, I thought.
Well, the cake pops are delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll find out. Somebody will text us. 877-881-1053. The fondant. Know. Yeah, the fondant.
Fondant is what you make when you make a cake. On a wedding cake.
My bad. Woolchuck.
Back to you.
Chocolate-covered bacon on a stick was actually really good at the fair from the 214. That sounds awesome. Jalapeno cheddar corn dog from a convenience store from the 682. Candy bacon getting love. The Dilly Bar getting love from the
Dilly Bar. The Dilly Bar is a legend.
Dilly Bar is incredible.
Legend.
Did not think of that one. That was one of the original DQ items.
Yeah. I was thinking about, like you said, like pops, chocolate popsicle on a stick. The Dilly Bar.
Fudgesicle. The Dilly Bar.
Fudgesicle, yeah.
9 is the cheese stick.
On a stick?
Cheese on a stick.
It's like
skewers. You can get cheese. You could do that probably when you go to what's like the melting pot.
Yeah.
Stab some cheese on there.
What did I see the other day? Somebody was taking beef and wrapping it around cheese on a stick.
Ooh.
So you had like a steak on a stick, but with a cheese type filling.
That sounds
almost like a Philly cheesesteak kind of situation. Yeah.
8 are marshmallows. Roasted marshmallows.
Oh, yeah.
Seven is caramel apples.
I always mess those up.
I was never a big caramel apple person.
It's too hard on the teeth.
No, I'm not.
It's hard on the teeth. That's not good.
Six is cotton candy. Kids love it. Five is a fruit skewer.
Oh, that's
fruit on the stick. Yeah. I mean, I guess if you have like a nice chocolate fountain,
yeah,
you could do some fun things.
Is that Golden Corral?
Yeah, Golden Corral does that.
Mm-hmm.
Four is your meat skewer.
Yeah, there you go.
Like chicken or beef or shrimp even. You could put it on the stick.
Yeah. Shrimp skewers are nice. Don't overdo them.
Don't overdo them.
Shrimp and steak together are always a pretty good combination with some onion.
So three is the kebabs.
There you go.
So that's where we're kind of doing it all, right? Vegetables and the meats. Yeah. That's some good stuff right there.
You could go straight meats.
You could go straight meats. All the meats. Number two is the corn dog. Best food on a stick. Number two, the corn dog.
Yeah, I really like it. Corn dogs are in its heyday right now. They haven't always been great. Sometimes they've been just a throwaway of the worst possible ingredients. Here's a corn dog, kid. Horrible ingredients. Now they're amazing.
I think, you know, you got to get the breading right on that thing.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, breading and the
dog. It's got to be a decent dog.
You got to be a decent dog. If that thing's falling apart and all,
These Korean corn dogs have changed the game. Have you seen these?
No.
They're doing all kinds of crazy stuff with filling in the outside.
What?
Things, they're coated in all kinds of stuff. Yeah, look up the Korean corn dogs.
I will.
You had me at Korea.
Your food ventures. Yeah, they're doing all, and I think the crust is usually pretty damn strong on those as well.
Yeah, don't have a bad crust.
But number one.
Oh, next level.
Most popular food on a stick is indeed the popsicle.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah,
people love their popsicles, especially on a hot summer day here in Texas.
Man, I go back to those, and I forget how good they were as kids.
Yeah.
The two-stick, the single-stick. I mean, there's all sorts of greatness to be had in a bag of popsicles. I would like to include as an honorable mention the Sugar Daddy. You know, you got the Sugar Babies, you got the Sugar Daddy. That's maybe the best candy on
the
a stick.
Sugar Daddy, okay.
Yeah. You ever had a Sugar Daddy?
No, never had a Sugar Daddy.
It's like a giant Sugar Baby on a stick. Yeah, yeah. It's great. I think chicken wings count. Okay, the bones are
the
sticks.
Bones could be a stick.
They're natural sticks, if you will. And as long as we're doing that, ribs. Yeah. That beef rib.
Oh,
that little piece of.
Okay.
How about the barbecue?
Like, you can kind of wave it around a little bit.
I think it counts.
Yeah.
How about that at Pecan Lodge the other day, that beef rib?
It's fantastic.
My huge.
Gosh, that thing was cooked perfectly, too.
We're going to catch up with Jared Sandler, our Rangers insider pre- and post-game show host, tells you what you need to know as the Rangers try to get their first win of the season tonight, pregame 6:30, and we're back with Sands here in the Nation. Thank you very much, Tritely, James Tritely, in for Lucius Alexander.
Jimmy Tritely.
This afternoon, as we're going all the way till 6:30, Rangers pregame taking off. Then they got four with the Red Sox this weekend. Okay, Jared Sandler set to join us now and talk more about that here on your home of the Rangers. And good afternoon, Jared. How the heck
He's
are
in
you?
The building!
Good afternoon, guys. I'm great. Hoping the Rangers can get win number one tonight.
Yeah, I'm hoping for that as well. But, you know, if they don't, no worries. It's 162. You know, well, I'm sure we'll get him later. But are you fired up for Jack Leiter tonight?
Yeah, I'm curious to see how it goes. You know, like I told you guys yesterday, I think this is a really good lineup. And Jack, like Eovaldi yesterday, not necessarily a guy who's great in holding runners. And, you know, the Red Sox will run. And so, you know, that's going to be a test for him for sure. But I'm just curious to see how it looks. And, you know, obviously one start is just one start, and he's going to have a much longer leash than that. But, you know, does the kick change show its face tonight? And how effective is that pitch? Is that just a spring training mirage, or is that something that can be effective in the regular season? And, you know, when he gets the two strikes on a hitter, well, first of all, you know, can he work from ahead? And then when he does, is he able to, when he's not throwing a pitch in the strike zone intentionally, is he at least able to throw competitively enough to where the hitter has a decision to make? And, you know, it just seemed like last year, times when he'd get in trouble, he wasn't throwing strike one. And when he was still having these 6-7 pitch at bats because he was throwing so many non-competitive pitches. And so I'm just curious to see how it looks. And then, you know, one of the other things is, what did he learn about last night? Because Nathan Eovaldi seemed to really lean on his curveball last night.
Mm-hmm.
And is that something that is a guide for Jack Leiter? Now, not every curveball is the same, and not everyone's got the same stuff. And so it doesn't mean if he doesn't use it, then, well, what's he doing? But, you know, I do wonder, young pitcher taking note of Nathan Eovaldi, the success he had with the curveball, is that a part of Jack Leiter's game plan tonight?
How's the rest of that Red Sox rotation they got to battle through here over the next three?
Yeah, Tanner Houck. So first of all, the Red Sox have three guys who would otherwise be in their rotation who are currently hurt. One of those guys being Lucas Giolito, Brian Bayo, who's a young pitcher who has great stuff, and then Cutter Crawford being the other. So, you know, just a reminder, everyone deals with this with their starting rotation. Tanner Houck is starting tonight. He was an all-star last year, but had a much better first half than second half. And, you know, so that he had a really bad spring training. And so I think people in Boston are wondering, well, was the first half just kind of, you know, what we're going to get? Or is it more of the second half? And the fact that he didn't have a good spring training, which, again, can mean absolutely nothing. But in Boston, you know, they're a little concerned. I think he's not a bad matchup for the Rangers, though, because he's not a big north-south guy. He's not an overpowering fastball guy. He's, you know, his sinker gets a lot of ground balls, actually, with a split finger. You know, he's a guy who I think, you know, the Rangers could fare well against. Adolis Garcia, you know, specifically with him, he's had a great track record against Houck, a couple homers, seven at-bats against him. So hopefully this is a game that we can see Adolis get going, and maybe Adolis is a good bet to hit the first home run of the year for the Rangers.
Jared, this might be a terrible question, but would the Red Sox have, like, a book on Jack Leiter? Would that be something that they would scout him through the spring? I know they play their spring training baseball in Florida, but how do they, in these early season matchups, is it just go out there and try and kind of navigate that without much of a book on these guys?
Yeah, it's a great question, and here's the thing. And 20 years ago, yeah, the answer would probably be no. They don't have a whole lot. You know, now when a guy comes up and makes his major league debut, you don't have nearly as much data on him as you do a guy who's been around for 10 years, but there's still a whole lot more data on that guy than there ever used to be.
Sure.
With Jack Leiter, I think the question brought us, the question's a great one. Yeah, they do have data on Jack, and yes, I think they do consider some of the spring training stuff, but not so much, you know, the way he uses his pitches, more, you know, where his pitches are, and hey, fastball sitting at this, and hey, he's added a kick change, and, you know, teams are aware of some of those storylines. They obviously have last year's stuff, but the thing with Jack Leiter, you know, the thought is he's young and he's still evolving, and so what you saw from Jack last year might not look a whole lot like what it's going to be this year, whether it's pitch usage, you know, the way he deploys his pitches, or just the effectiveness. Like, they might say, hey, this guy really struggles to throw his fastball for a strike. And
right,
that was true last year. Maybe it's not true anymore, right? So it is a little tougher, I think, with a younger pitcher. It's not that the data's not there. It's that it's tougher, I think, to understand what to make of that data.
So I'm hammering the more on all Adolis Garcia tonight on Prize Picks. Jared, why is that a
Prize Picks like it.
Yep, why is that smart?
Well, I think in large part what I just said about, you know, his track record against Tanner Houck, 4-for-7, a couple homers. It's obviously not a tremendous sample size, but, you know, you also look at what Tanner Houck does and what Adolis Garcia struggles with, and, you know, that it lines up well. Adolis struggles with guys who can really, you know, put the, you know, push the velocity on the fastball and elevate it. Tanner Houck is not that guy. Tanner Houck's a guy who, yeah, I mean, listen, everyone, it seems like, can throw mid-90s these days, but he's more, like I said, sinker splitter, and then he's got a really good sweeper that he likes to use both to righties and lefties. And so, you know, that's the type of stuff that Adolis does well with. I don't know if you guys remember, you know, when the Rangers faced Zach Eflin in the playoffs in 2023 against Tampa, Zach Eflin's more of an east-west pitcher. Adolis Garcia, yeah, you know, really tends to match up better with guys who work more east-west than north-south, and that's Tanner Houck's game.
Is it an overreaction to say that this team goes as far as Adolis Garcia takes them this year?
Well, I would say it's an overreaction just because you look at how one player just can't affect a team, in theory, that much, right? I mean, when the Angels had Shohei Ohtani, as good as he was, as unbelievable as he was, they couldn't make the playoffs. The Braves won the World Series without Ronald Acuna Jr. for most of the year, right? So, in theory, I think that's an overreaction, especially when you consider the depth of this lineup. You know, they should be able to withstand that. With that said, Zach, I do think there's things that are unquantifiable sometimes, and it just seems like, you know, this Adolis is the type of guy who can, you know, the lows can be low, But those super high highs, they don't just exist for a game, right? They exist for a couple weeks, and he helps you bank like 10 wins over a couple week stretch sometimes, you know, because he just gets going. And the thing that I think stands out to me about Adolis, which maybe doesn't get enough attention, the big moment, you know, we don't use the word clutch enough, I think, with Adolis. The big moment seems to only elevate his play. Or if you don't believe that guys can get better in those moments, he certainly seems to minimize the way a big moment can diminish his play. And I think there's something to be said about guys who can get it done in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings against some of the best, you know, toughest pitchers in the game.
Hey, Jared, in the last minute or so, Corey Seager with the calf, I assume he's in the lineup tonight as a shortstop. He's never going to make excuses. Is this something that's bothering him and he's just going to continue to play through it?
Yeah, I think so for now. And hopefully it's something that will go away. But, you know, he was healthy enough to play short yesterday, but they wanted to give him another day of rest from the field so that Jock Peterson could DH today and they didn't need a DH Corey. But, yeah, this guy, 6'4", shortstop, he plays through a lot that people don't realize. And I think this is just another example of that. But hopefully it's not something that that will linger throughout the season. I think the belief is that it's not going to be that type of an injury, but, you know, I guess we'll wait and see.
Jared, if this bullpen fails again this weekend, I'm going to have you address my explosive bullpen take on Monday. How does that sound?
Let's do it. Hey, I'm all about it.
Let's go.
Happy to do it.
Have a great weekend, man. Go Rangers.
All right, fellas, go Rangers. See you guys later.
He's at Jared Sandler on Twitter, a must-follow for Rangers fans everywhere. Pregame coming up at 6:30 tonight, game 2 of 4 against the Bo Sox. Football's finest coming up. Wolchuk, where are you taking us?
Romo's favorite celebration, social media roast, and Hallmark doubling down. That's next.